This is Intersection, I'm Matthew Petty. Boeing's newest aircraft, the 737 MAX, remains grounded after the second fatal crash in the space of just a few months. Boeing says it's working with investigators to figure out what caused the Ethiopian Airlines crash this month and the Lion Air crash last October. So what does the grounding mean for airlines, for passengers and for Boeing? We're joined by Dr. Clint Balog, Associate Professor of Aeronautics at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Daytona Beach. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
You must have been sort of following the story fairly closely of what was happening with the Boeing 737 MAX 8 aircraft before the crash of the Ethiopian Airlines flight, correct?
Yes, that's correct. I work in the field of crew platform automation. It's where I consult. It's what I teach. It's where I do research. So I stay current with all of the automated systems currently being employed in aircraft of all kinds. So I was familiar with the 737 MAX even before the Lion Air incident last October. And certainly I have done more research and more investigation since that time.
When news broke of the Ethiopian Airlines crash and when you learned what kind of aircraft it was, what sort of thoughts did you start to have about what might happen next for both Boeing, for the FAA, and of course for the airlines that operate this aircraft?
Well, certainly I knew that the 737 MAX series was going to get some increased scrutiny because of the fact that it was the second accident with that line of aircraft in approximately 6 months. Certainly, I knew that there would be comparisons between Ethiopian Airlines and Lion Air to see if there was any similarities between the two accidents, other than the similarities you see on the face of the fact that it's a similar aircraft, both relatively new, and both accidents happened during the takeoff and departure phase of flight. So certainly I knew that the 737 was going to start getting some closer scrutiny.
It can take a long time to discover the cause of aircraft accidents, right? I mean, there's a lot of data that has to be sifted through. There's physical evidence to be examined. Sometimes it can take, you know, months to find out what caused an aircraft to crash, if not longer. Does Boeing have the luxury of that time, or do these airlines, I mean, can they afford to sort of wait around for long to figure out what went wrong?
Well, it's not a matter of having the luxury. You have to take the time that it takes to do this right. You don't want to go down the wrong path and come to wrong conclusions. So you have to be certain about where you're going and what conclusions you're drawing. So we have to take the time to do that. In the meantime, you have to look at what the preliminary evidence is telling you. And the preliminary evidence may not necessarily tell you what was causal in an accident, but it could tell you what was not causal in an accident. And that may change what happens with the aircraft and how it's employed, whether or not it's grounded.
And it's not just the 737 MAX 8, right? There's also the 737 MAX 9. Is there a big difference between those two planes?
No, the aircraft, from a system standpoint and functional standpoint and an operational standpoint, they are virtually identical. The main difference between those two aircraft is the length of the fuselage and therefore the seating capacity. But systems-wise, they're essentially the same aircraft.
I guess we're hearing from Boeing that they are working on a software upgrade. How important is the software component of flying these planes, and you know, how much control do pilots have? I mean, if there's a software glitch, are they able to take over control and just sort of fly it like they would in days before systems were computerized as they are now?
Yes, certainly pilots, particularly of Boeing aircraft, always have ultimate authority over the aircraft. Even with automated systems that are, of course, software driven, there are procedures in place for overriding certain automated systems if they experience a malfunction. So that option is always there. There are two basic automation philosophies that are out there for manufacturers. One is called automation-centric, and one is called human-centric. In a human-centric automation scheme or philosophy, the pilot ultimately has authority over the aircraft, and there are reduced limits on what the pilot is able to do. the pilot can do more with the aircraft to override the software limits. In an automation-centric system, the automation has a bit more final authority. Neither of these philosophies is right or wrong. They're different. Airbus typically employs a more automation-centric system, while Boeing typically employs a more human-centric automation philosophy. Because of that, specifically with Boeing aircraft, the pilots always have a bit more authority over the aircraft. So there are always ways to override the automation if it becomes necessary.
Obviously, the 737 is the most popular. They're the most sort of numerous aircraft. I guess people call it the workhorse of many airlines because it's so versatile. But what about other aircraft made by Boeing? To your knowledge, is this the kind of issue that could affect other airplanes as well, like maybe the 777 or the 787 Dreamliner?
Well, again, we don't know what has happened with these accidents yet, so it's impossible to say if whatever happened with one or both of these accidents could affect other Boeing aircraft. If it is related to MCAS, as far as I know, MCAS is specific to the 737 MAX series, so that wouldn't be a problem with other Boeing aircraft.
And just remind our listeners, what does MCAS stand for?
MCAS stands for Maneuvering Characteristics Augmentation System. It's a system designed to help prevent the aircraft from stalling.
Which is when it's not flying fast enough, so it doesn't get lift, right?
Well, yeah, certainly speed is one component of a stall. A stall is basically when the aircraft wings don't generate enough lift to overcome the weight of the aircraft. So it loses flying speed. It loses the ability to remain in the air and starts to descend.
So one of the questions that people were asking was, you know, why did the FAA take so long to decide that it was time to ground the aircraft? Like a lot of countries, you know, their aviation authorities decided that it was better to be safe than sorry, and they were going to ground these planes until it was figured out what the cause was, whereas it took some time for the FAA to decide to do the same thing here. Is that a conversation that folks who study the industry are having as well, kind of wondering what was going on there at the FAA?
Well, I'm sure some folks are having that conversation, but it's you have to understand how the FAA makes that decision. The FAA does not guess. The FAA does not work off of emotion. The FAA is not concerned with what other regulatory agencies around the world are doing. The FAA makes the decision about grounding an aircraft based on data and information. And until they have the information that says, yes, we need to ground this aircraft, they won't make the decision to do so. And keep in mind, when you ground an aircraft, there are other implications that come along with that have to be considered. They aren't the primary consideration. Safety is always the primary consideration. But when you ground an aircraft like this, there are implications to the American commerce system. There are economic implications to America. There are severe implications to the flying public. So it's not just a matter of grounding the aircraft out of an abundance of caution, because if you do that and it turns out there was no reason to do that, you have invoked a lot of other implications that may not have been necessary to do.
It's interesting. I mean, you mentioned there are all these different factors that go into the decision to take and to ground an aircraft. And in the case of MCO, Orlando International Airport, you know, one of the messages that came through from the airport was that we are prepared to, you know, accept these planes if they are grounded. That's another thing to take into consideration, I guess. What do you do with the planes once they're no longer able to fly? They presumably would have to be parked at an airport for who knows how long. They may have to be put in a hangar somewhere. It's a big logistical problem if you're an airline and you're thinking about how to kind of reroute all your planes and you know, fill in the gaps if you're missing some of the fleet.
Well, that's absolutely true. When the aircraft is grounded, if it's an immediate grounding, it stays on the ground wherever it lands right after the grounding is made official. So it has to be stored. It has to be maintained while it's there. It has to be looked after, which is an expense. But as far as the impact it has on the airline and the flying public, it really depends on how big a percentage of the fleet the aircraft is. Southwest has 34 of these aircraft. American has 24 and United has 14. For American and United, it is a smaller percentage of their large fleets than it is for Southwest. It's a smaller percentage of their total available seats. So it's a smaller impact for United and American. With 34 aircraft and a smaller overall fleet than the other two airlines, this is a bigger impact for Southwest. And depending on how long the grounding goes on, they will eventually have to make some other arrangements to replace those available seats, either leasing other aircraft or cutting back the number of flights, which impacts their revenue. And airlines work on a fairly thin revenue margin, contrary to what most people seem to think when they buy their tickets. So these are important decisions, and these are difficult decisions.
And some of those airlines, I understand, are taking legal action against Boeing, right? They're saying this is not something that we were factoring in. We bought this plane on the understanding that it would be airworthy, and it's not.
Well, yeah, and that's an area that's, as a scientist and an engineer, that's outside of my field of expertise when we start getting into lawsuits. I wouldn't be surprised if lawsuits started being filed. But I can't even begin to speak to the merit of lawsuits like that.
Mm-hmm. What about the safety aspect, though? I mean, what would you say to folks who may be having some questions about flying in general? Because the line we hear oftentimes is that it's a lot safer than other means of travel, even though a crash is obviously catastrophic. But at the same time, you have to kind of look at the numbers and say air travel is by and large safer than, say, driving a car or other forms of transportation. But does that kind of message get through? And especially if you have such a wide scale grounding like this, does that shake people's confidence in flying, do you think?
Well, certainly it does shake some people's confidence in flying. And yes, statistically, aviation is far and away the safest way to get from point A to point B. But when something does happen in aviation, it's not small. It's dramatic, typically. And that's that. The fact that aviation is the safest way to travel is small comfort to people who are already somewhat edgy about flying to begin with. And that's the issue. So what I would say to people who are hesitant to fly on a MAX 8 or a MAX 9 when the grounding is lifted and the aircraft are flying again, if you're uncomfortable, don't get on that aircraft. Look for a flight on another aircraft. Based on what I know so far, I have no problem myself getting on a Boeing 737 MAX. And more importantly, I would have no problem at this point with my family getting on a Boeing 737 MAX aircraft.
And as a former test pilot, you know more about the workings of how these planes are tested and developed and ultimately deemed, safe than many people. Does that kind of go through your mind when you're boarding a commercial flight, or are you just like any other member of the traveling public? You're worried about how much legroom you're going to have and what snacks they're serving, whether there's anything decent to watch on the plane.
I've been involved in flight test for 42 years, and as a professional aviator for 42 years. I know a lot of people in the FAA. I know how aircraft are certified. I know how stringent the regulations are. The people I know in the FAA, especially in the certification branches, are among the very best and most professional aviation people I know. Safety is always their concern. So when an aircraft is certified to fly, I have no concerns about getting on it from a certification standpoint. And yes, it's 6'3" and 200 pounds. My biggest concern is how much leg room I'm going to have and how long the flight is and how comfortable am I going to be.
And I guess every grounding is going to be different because every aircraft is different, but is there any indication just how long these planes might be grounded for based on what you know from previous groundings?
No, there's no indication. It's really going to depend on how the investigation unfolds and what the investigation uncovers about what caused, and more importantly, what did not cause these accidents.
So what are you looking out for next? What's the next thing to be paying attention to in this story?
Well, the thing I would caution the general public and the media about is there's going to be a lot of information coming out from a lot of different sources. You really have to focus on the reliable sources, the NTSB, some of the more competent investigating authorities. That's the information to focus on. There's going to be a lot of bad information out in the public. For instance, we're hearing that these flight profiles look similar. Number one, I don't know that that's the case firsthand. But number two, even if they are similar, that doesn't mean they emanate from similar causes. There can be multiple different causes that result in similar profiles. So don't jump to conclusions. Wait for the good data to come out and find out what really happened with these aircraft. Are you familiar with the game Minesweeper?
Yeah.
Okay. In Minesweeper, you get very specific clues. And if you follow the clues and do only what the clues tell you to do and tell you what's safe, you have a chance of winning the game. If you start to make assumptions based on what those clues probably mean, you're going to step on a mine and lose the game. The FAA, the NTSB don't make assumptions. They follow where the data takes them. They understand what the data is telling them, but more importantly, they understand what the data is not telling them. And that's how they arrive at causal and contributing factors to an accident. Follow that. That's what's going to be the truth.
Well, Dr. Clint Balog, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Dr. Clint Balog is a former engineering test pilot, corporate pilot, and flight test engineer. He's an associate professor of aeronautics at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Daytona Beach. We spoke to him via Skype. Still to come, the Lake Mary High School community is in mourning after a 17-year-old student took her own life on campus last week. We check in with pediatrician Dr. Candace Jones about how to talk to teens about suicide and mental health.
We want to say to our children, you know, how are you feeling? I can imagine how you feel, and just encourage them to talk to you. You know, oftentimes I'm fine, you know, stop asking me, but, you know, let them know I'm here. Whenever you want to talk, let's talk. I'm concerned for you. I love you. I want to listen if you need help.
And will NASA's big rocket ever get off the ground? The Space Launch System has been dogged by delays, and now there's even a suggestion that commercial space companies could be brought in to help the Orion program.
This has been in talks for a while, just never publicly and never by the top of NASA, the administrator. And so what you're seeing here is a turn where many people thought that NASA should go in this direction. And so it does, in fact, free up NASA funds to do other things, such as build the Lunar Gateway or build a lunar lander or the other things that NASA is trying to accomplish with its limited dollars.
Intersections back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. A 17-year-old student at Lake Mary High School died last week from a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Classes were cancelled the day after, and grief counsellors brought in to help students deal with the tragedy. Seminole County Sheriff Dennis Lima spoke at a press conference after the incident. He said parents should talk to their children about it. But how do you talk to teens or younger kids about suicide and mental health more broadly? What are some of the things to be mindful of? Well, to help us navigate the issue, we're joined by pediatrician Dr. Candace Jones. Dr. Jones, thanks for coming back.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, how would you say staff, teachers, parents, students would deal with a situation like what happened at Lake Mary last week? I mean, it's a tragedy, obviously, and the circumstances pretty tough to contemplate, I guess.
Yes, it is. It's very tough for everyone, and I'm sure our hearts go out to the family and the students at the school, and it should have all parents raising an alarm and talking to their children. Absolutely.
Well, let me ask you about then how you broach the subject with your patients. What are some of the steps you go through?
Right. So as a pediatrician, we are, you know, mandated, or we believe in asking our patients a lot of questions and giving our parents a lot of anticipatory guidance. So there's tons of screening. By the time a child hits 12, we should be doing depression screenings. That's what's recommended by the American Academy of Pediatrics.
And that's no matter what situation the child is in?
Right. We want to prevent. So we want to ask these things before they start happening. And we know that a lot of parents, the studies show that half of parents don't even know that their children have thought about killing themselves when they surveyed parents.
So it's a lot more common than
Right, right. Just the thought. So we automatically, when I do a physical on a child, they come in once a year if they're well and healthy. My physical exam is not just about their body and physical health. I'm thinking socially, psychologically, academics. I go into every aspect of their health. And those are some of the tough questions we ask. And we ask them separately from parents. Mm-hmm. Have you thought about hurting yourself? Do you feel sad, hopeless, you know, worthless? You know, we talk about sex and drugs. They're likely not to answer those questions truthfully in the presence of their parents. So we do ask separately. And I have had children to say yes to suicide. Mm. And then we have to have a conversation together with the parent. And they're always shocked to hear it.
Mm-hmm. What about the idea of suicide having this taboo around it? Because it has been a taboo topic. I mean, even thinking about the way the media treats it, standards have changed a little bit.
Right.
What about for healthcare professionals, even for teachers, for parents? Has the way people think about tackling the issue and trying to help kids out, has that changed as well?
You know, I think about even when I was growing up, and I think some of this is still pervasive in the community, that mental illness, addressing mental health concerns, have a stigma of shame or weakness around it. And oftentimes we think when you put it into the air, you're giving that child the idea. Mm-hmm. That is a myth. That is incorrect, and that's the very thing that makes this always a big surprise when it happens, and we could have possibly prevented it. Mm-hmm. So it does not give the child the idea. Our young people, especially our teens, know about all of this stuff. They're hearing it. They're discussing it. So we need to be realistic about that and know that it's a possibility and have the conversation with them. So you can equip them for all the stressors that are coming their way, and give them rational plans to get over those adversities.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that Sheriff Lima said in his press conference last week was that parents obviously have this instinct to shield their kids from some of these traumatic things. But in some cases, that might not work. You have to actually get some of these ideas out in the open and talk about them.
I totally agree, because what we think we're shielding may be unrealistic, like I said, because the kids know. Mm-hmm. And we're, as an adult, are not getting past our own fears or discomforts. That's what's happening. But we know that the parents' greatest tool that they have to protect their kids is their relationship, their communication, their connection. And so we definitely need to have these tough conversations with them. Earlier, the better.
Mm-hmm. Is it getting easier for parents to have these conversations?
I think in some aspects it is. You know, as generations are moving forward, the younger generations, the millennial parents and things of that nature, I definitely see they are able to have those conversations a little better. But we still have some parents in my generation that are just old school, and it's tough for them.
Mm-hmm. What about the incidence of suicide in teens and sometimes younger kids too? Has that changed at all in recent years?
Yes, it has. We are seeing, first, I would say that this is still rare, okay? Mm-hmm. But we are seeing an uptick in the percentages of young people from the age of 12 to 21, children, teens, and young adults with mental health concerns and with the propensity to self-harm. Studies have shown that even recently as of this year. So that further tells us that we have to be aware and put things in place to prevent it. Mm-hmm. Some of those risk factors are newer phenomenons as well. So what we're seeing more of, as we all know, social media, cyberbullying, just something as simple as the lack of sleep that our young people are getting because they're on screens all the time. Mm-hmm. All of that lends to your emotional and mental well-being, because it gets into their emotional strife or the conflicts that come up that create these traumatic experiences for them, mm-hmm. or the tension that puts them at stress.
Mm-hmm. So Dr. Candace Jones, if social media and exposure to social media or you know, the use of social media, depending on the student or the kid, is one of the risk factors, how do you recommend parents deal with it or regulate it.
Right. So we want to know what the risk factors are for our child, mm-hmm. right? If you see that your son or daughter is using social media in extreme time frames, then you want to talk to them about that, that there is increase for depression, anxiety, and incidents of cyberbullying, the more you're on there, right? And we know those things lead to the mental health concerns. Mm-hmm. And so you just want to help them navigate that space, show them the data, show them the studies, talk to them about it. And you still are their parent and you still can set some rules. And so you give them some time limits. I love the AAP's Family Media Use Plan.
Mm-hmm. What is the AAP?
The American Academy of Pediatrics mm-hmm. Family Media Use Plan. And you can go to their website, healthychildren.org, and you can set up a plan for your family from small children to teenagers, how you want to structure those screens and that media use in your family.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just getting ahead of the game.
What about modeling good behavior if you're a parent?
So important. You know, my son will say to me sometimes, "Mom, put your phone down." And so we fall into the same trap where we're not as connected to them, not using all the time we used to play or go outside or really being fully engaged because we're on our phones, whether it's social media or handling business-related things. But we have to put our phones down as well and give them our full attention.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what about some of the warning signs? And I'm wondering if it's tricky sometimes to navigate what the real warning signs might be and what might be things that aren't as important to pay attention to, if that makes sense.
Right, right. You know, one thing I would say, that's great that you said that, because oftentimes the period of adolescence is, we all went through it, but we kind of forgot,
mm-hmm.
And times have changed.
It's a bit of an emotional roller coaster.
Right, it's an emotional roller coaster. Puberty, the hormones, all the new things they're navigating, all their academic pressures and the expectations that we want them to live up to, peer pressure, all of that stuff is there. And so it's a period where, you know, adversities can come and they can seem out of sync. So we have to watch them and monitor them and stay connected to them. So if things change drastically, so I like to remember facts, F-A-C-T-S. So if they start to exhibit feelings of sadness, hopelessness, I'm giving up, they just change. If they start to exhibit actions that are riskier than what they ever used to take, changes in their behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're withdrawn, they're isolating, they're more irritable, sleeping a lot more. And, you know, you might see a teen that's sleeping a lot more. So it's not one thing, but it's kind of an overall change.
Mm-hmm. What does the T stand for?
And the T is making a threat. And this is the thing that, you know, they can say, "Oh, I just don't even want to live. I'll just kill myself. I'm so sick of this. I just want to give up." You know, those types of things, they're throwing those cues out. We have to take that seriously. We can't just say, "Oh, I went through that. That's the teenage years," and minimize and like, "Oh, you'll get over it." Because overwhelmingly, most teens do. This is rare.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't want to lose one life. And if a child makes that threat, if they say words like that, we have to take that seriously and talk to them. What do you mean by that?
Mm-hmm.
And not in a punitive way. And then I would also see their doctor, their pediatrician, just to make sure that that wasn't a real threat and watch them closely. The S was sudden trauma or sudden loss. Something drastic happens. Someone dies. They were extremely embarrassed for something they did or feel extremely guilty about something, a huge breakup, something sudden. A lot of the times it's a young person who already has struggled with mental health problems, but sometimes it's not. It could just be something so overwhelming that they think of that as an option.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the first three factors you pointed out in that FACTS mnemonic, I mean, mm-hmm. those are things that every teenager goes through,
right?
Like the feelings, the actions, the changes.
Right.
I mean, all of that, you're going to see that anyway, right? So it's a matter of sort of figuring out which
yes.
bits to pay attention to. And as you say, if everything's happening at once, and it all seems to be moving in a certain direction, you've got to take some action, and that might mean just sitting down having a conversation.
That's right. Know your child. You knowing them and having that strong relationship with them and communicating with them, you will get the sense that they're out of their baseline, you know, and this is off. Yeah, she's like that sometimes, but this is totally off. I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. You know, we have great intuition as parents. And one fact is that 4 out of 5 teens who attempt suicide gave clear warning signs. Hmm. And so hindsight, we have to develop that foresight to see that.
When something happens like the tragedy at Lake Mary High School last week, when something like that happens, that's going to have a profound impact on friends, on the classmates. What do you tell kids who might have sort of seen or know somebody who this has happened to, and how do you kind of help them deal with that?
Right. It can be just as tough for them. She had friends, you know? And so when we talk about children who experience any type of trauma like that, we definitely want to watch them as well. Kind of goes into the same conversation. And we want to say to our children, you know, how are you feeling? You know, I can imagine how you feel, and just encourage them to talk to you. You know, oftentimes I'm fine, you know, stop asking me, but, you know, let them know I'm here whenever you want to talk. Let's talk. I'm concerned for you. I love you. I want to listen if you need help. But you still need to straight up ask them that question. Mm-hmm. You know, have you thought about killing yourself? Are you thinking about that now?
And that's a tough question.
It feels funny. It feels funny even when I say it, even when I say it to my patients. But it has to be, you have to say it.
Some final thoughts, Dr. Candace Jones?
Yes, I just want parents, like we said, you know, be aware that this is a possibility, and that make sure that we know those warning signs. And if your child, one thing I think we may not have discussed, if your child answers yes to that question or you see clear warning signs, you want to sound the alarm. Get them to your doctor, create a safety plan for them, don't leave them alone, and get them into care. We know that a lot of children who are found to have these concerns go untreated, and we can't do that. So whatever your avenue is, your faith base, you know, therapy, seeing a psychiatrist, you need to let the teachers, the school know, so that everywhere this child is, there is a safety plan and a support network, a buffer for them to know that they have someone to go to and to keep them safe.
Well, Dr. Candace Jones, pediatrician, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, thank you for having me.
And Dr. Candace Jones is a pediatrician with a practice in Pine Hills. Coming up, NASA's big rocket, the Space Launch System, is as tall as the Statue of Liberty and designed to take humans into deep space. But after a series of delays, will it ever get off the ground?
This has been in talks for a while, just never publicly and never by the top of NASA, the administrator. And so what you're seeing here is a turn where many people thought that NASA should go in this direction. And so it does, in fact, free up NASA funds to do other things, such as build the Lunar Gateway or build a lunar lander or the other things that NASA is trying to accomplish with its limited dollars.
That's ahead when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. NASA's next generation rocket, the SLS, or Space Launch System, is over budget and behind schedule. The rocket, which is taller than the Statue of Liberty, was scheduled to launch the agency's Orion capsule on a test mission around the moon back in 2017, but it's been delayed multiple times. The most up-to-date target launch date is 2020, but it's likely that that will slip as well. Speaking to a Senate committee late last week, NASA's Administrator Jim Bridenstine floated a new idea for the mission: launch it on a commercial rocket. So is the future of NASA's biggest rocket in the hands of the private space industry? And what does that mean for the program here on the Space Coast? To talk more about the program, I'm joined by 90.7 Space reporter Brendan Byrne. Brendan, thanks again for joining us.
Anytime, Matt.
And Laura Forsick, she is a space policy analyst and founder of Astrolytical. Laura, welcome back to Intersection.
Thanks so much.
Brendan, if I could start with you, what's the purpose of the SLS mission?
So this SLS mission is called EM-1, Exploration Mission 1, and the goal is to take the Orion space capsule, which is also being developed by NASA, on a trip around the moon. So this will launch from Kennedy Space Center, head into low Earth orbit, make an injection, and then head towards the moon and fly around it. So it's basically just to prove that this hardware can survive in deep space on a mission around the moon before putting humans in it for a future mission, which is going to be called EM-2.
Laura, if I could come to you for a minute. Orion has actually already been up, or at least one of those capsules has been up into space before, right? Like they've proved that it can go into space and come back again.
Right, that's correct. Orion flew December 2014 on a Delta IV Heavy for its first test. And so this next test, EM-1, would be a test of... Originally, it was going to be the test of SLS and Orion together before the first crewed mission in EM-2. However, the plan is now in flux, whether or not that will be a test of SLS with Orion or whether that will be Orion with another commercial rocket, whether that is a Delta IV Heavy or another one.
So, Brendan, what's causing the delays?
I think the question is what's not causing delays at this point. This is a $12 billion program and counting. There have been countless delays, whether it be from congressional funding. There's been issues with manufacturing. There's also been some issues developing the software to run this. So the delays are there's quite a few of them, and that's just keeps moving this schedule to the right by 6 months or a year every time a review comes around.
It must be a bit frustrating for those engineers working on this program.
Oh, it absolutely is. You know, you've got a lot of the hardware is being built here at the Kennedy Space Center. The launch pad is ready to go, but there still continues to be these delays and the rocket can't get stacked.
Laura, your perspective on that, I mean, what must that be like for those folks who have invested their careers into getting this rocket off the ground, so to speak?
Oh, it is frustrating, and not just this one, but before SLS, it was a rocket called the Ares. And mm-hmm. So the Ares transitioned into the SLS. And so some people have been working on the heavy lift rocketry at NASA for decades and not seen very much progress. So you can't really blame the engineers on the ground. It's more the managers of the program that have sort of mismanaged the funding. And of course, there's always delays whenever you're breaking ground on new technology.
Brendan, last week, NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine spoke about some new ideas for the mission, maybe a workaround for this program. What are some of ideas to try and shortcut these delays in the future?
Right. So speaking to a Senate committee last week, NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine, he said, you know, June 2020 is the date that we are aiming for. We need to hold ourselves accountable to these dates. He doesn't want to see this slip anymore. But that means that they're going to have to dramatically rethink this program. So here was his idea. He's speaking to a congressional committee last week.
We need to consider as an agency all options to accomplish that objective. Some of those options would include launching the Orion crew capsule and the European service module on a commercial rocket. It's been done before, actually not with the European service module, but certainly there are opportunities to utilize commercial capabilities to put the Orion crew capsule and the European service module in orbit around the moon by June of 2020. Which was our originally stated objective.
Now, this kind of took the whole space community by surprise, because this was a very dramatic thing for the head of a NASA agency to be going to a Senate committee or someone in Congress and saying, we're going to dramatically change the architecture of this program and actually, you know, punt it to commercial partners to do this as well. So it was a big rift in the community last week.
What are the commercial partners saying about this? Are they saying great opportunity or like, no, thank you, we've got other things on our hands?
Well, the details really haven't been rolled out, and I've got to say that Bridenstine did, you know, send a letter to NASA employees saying, listen, I still believe in SLS. This is just a way to fast track this mission here. And, you know, don't worry, we're still fully behind SLS. Mm-hmm. SpaceX would be one of those companies that could do this, right? They haven't really said anything about this. It would be a competitive bidding process, and they haven't mentioned anything like that. United Launch Alliance, which is a joint venture between Lockheed Martin and Boeing, they said they would support this. They'd be happy to help, you know, NASA's get to play places like the moon and Mars. But keep in mind, Boeing is one of the contractors on SLS, which is also causing a lot of these delays. A government accountability office recently said, you know, Boeing management has been a cause for these delays as well. So there's a lot of nuances in this whole thing, and it'll be a very interesting bidding process if it comes to that.
Laura, the idea of, and this might be a little bit off track, but I thought the idea of having a commercial partners work on the low Earth orbit program, the commercial crew program, was to free up NASA to work on these bigger picture things like developing the space launch system, like getting out into deep space. Are we kind of coming back full circle again and saying now that, well, maybe commercial partners have a better sense of how to get this thing going than NASA? Is that sort of flipping things on its head a little bit?
I think what you're seeing is a more openness towards a new way of contracting where NASA does not have to be the builder of every hardware that they use. And so there's more willingness to, especially if there's proven technology such as a ULA Delta IV or a Falcon Heavy from SpaceX, proven technology from commercial sources. Not saying that the commercial sources can do it better. And remember, SLS and NASA hardware in general is contracted out to commercial companies. It's just a different way of perceiving how NASA gets its mission done.
Does it seem like this has any chance of succeeding, or is it kind of a bit of a desperate play by Jim Bridenstine to say, look, we just have to get this program done. We're going to do it by any means necessary, and that might mean turning that program over to private companies rather than having NASA work on this space launch system and have NASA be the chief architect of that big rocket?
Yeah, far from desperate, it's actually quite calculated. This has been in talks for a while, just never publicly and never by the top of NASA, the administrator. And so what you're seeing here is a turn where many people thought that NASA should go in this direction. And so it does, in fact, going back to your earlier statement, free up NASA funds to do other things such as build the Lunar Gateway or build a lunar lander or the other things that NASA is trying to accomplish with its limited dollars.
What kind of impact would it have on the NASA engineers and designers and all the other folks who are working on this project?
Yeah, so the surprise announcement did take some of the engineers by surprise in that they were still working on and are still working on integrating SLS and Orion for the EM-1 test flight, which at this point we're probably looking at the end of 2020 or early 2021. And so it does throw some of their work out the window. However, this is not a final done deal. This was a proposal in front of a Senate committee that either this week or next, we should hear back whether or not they're going to go in this direction.
And there's always bureaucracy. There's kind of red tape to get through. Things don't necessarily happen quickly when you're talking about the federal government, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, it all ties to the president's budget request, which was released last week, Monday, where SLS gets a 17% cut in the president's budget request. However, the members of Congress, in particular, Senator Shelby of Alabama and the former Senator Bill Nelson of Florida, were very supportive of SLS. Now, Bill Nelson did not win his reelection campaign. And so what you're seeing is fewer champions in Congress for SLS.
And that's even with more money overall for NASA?
Yeah, NASA got a bit of a cut with SLS, but in other places such as the Lunar Gateway and ISS and other areas, it got a funding increase.
Just remind our listeners what exactly the Lunar Gateway is.
So that is a concept where we're going to put a base into lunar orbit so that our astronauts will have a place to stay for 30 to 90 days at a time with the anticipation that they would do these short lunar visits and also a way for the international community to come and get involved in our hardware. So it would be an international partnership similar to the International Space Station, but on a smaller scale.
Brendan, how do you see this playing out? Are we looking at just even further delays? I mean, is there a chance, still a glimmer of possibility, that SLS will one day launch and this entire system, as NASA conceived it, will be blasting off to Mars or the moon or deep space in some regard?
Well, there's quite a few ways to look at this. Laura brought up a very good point where that in Congress, SLS had quite a few allies, and some of those allies are now gone, like Senator Bill Nelson. So it'll be very interesting to see how much power Shelby will wield to kind of help get the money where it needs to go. This is a $12 billion and counting project. I don't think that Congress would be able to just let that go. You know, I think they'll want to see something from this. And also, a commercial mission would be complicated. It would be at least two launches to get this hardware into space. They would have to dock the Orion, and then the service module would be launched separately. So there's a possibility that you could have two competing companies actually launching these two pieces of hardware. They would have to work together to get these to dock in space, and you'd have to write a brand new program, brand new software. So a June 2020 date is ambitious, to say the least.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, is something that we've been doing for decades. So there's a little bit of politics being played in the wording. Yes, it would add complication to do docking, but it is something we've been doing since Gemini, Apollo, and we do regularly building the International Space Station and other missions. So there's a little bit of politics being played with how complicated launching two separate missions might be.
So you're saying, Laura, that there's some maybe vested interest who's saying, look, we don't want to get off this wagon now because this is the way we've always done it, whereas others might be saying, well, hey, it's not that complex. Just give us a bit of time. We can figure it out.
Exactly.
And to Laura's point, just recently, you know, SpaceX docked with the International Space Station. So, you know, you're seeing the commercial partners working with the agencies as well. So there's lots of ways to look at this. But I think Laura will agree that still a June 2020 date is still pretty ambitious.
Absolutely. Yeah, we definitely expect to see it delayed until November is the date that's floating around, November 2020, and perhaps 2021 or even later. It's already been delayed. The original launch date was 2017.
Just on that SpaceX docking, Brendan, you mentioned to me just in conversation a few days back that the Russian cosmonaut, they were a bit nervous about what was going to happen.
They were a little concerned at first. One of the concerns was that SpaceX only had one computer to do the docking, but those concerns were alleviated before the launch, and they seemed to be quite happy with it. And actually, some of the greatest, one of the coolest images that we got from that docking was from a Russian cosmonaut. So they're very interested in having another ride to space as well. And I think that those initial concerns were alleviated by the time it launched.
Laura, just back to the Orion program, I mean, some of the companies we've mentioned that could be potential partners if the SLS isn't the rocket that's used to get it into space down the track, you know, Lockheed Martin, ULA, Boeing, SpaceX potentially. But are there some companies that we haven't talked about that might also be interested in partnering up on this?
Yeah, so not as soon as 2020 or 2021, but eventually Blue Origin is going to build a larger rocket called New Glenn. They already have their suborbital rocket, New Shepard, but they are building a larger rocket than New Glenn, which would probably have the capability to do a similar mission. SpaceX is not only just building its Falcon Heavy, which it tested earlier, but it also is building a big rocket called Starship, formerly BFR, and it's in the process of building that, and it's going to be testing that soon. And then there are rocket companies that already have a capability, such as ULA's Delta IV Heavy, that are also building another rocket. So the Atlas V is being replaced by the Vulcan. So we should see that coming on board in the next few years as well.
And that SpaceX rocket you mentioned is quite striking in design, right? It's almost kind of, there's something quite retro about the shape and the color of it.
I think that was on purpose, I do believe. It brings a kind of a nostalgia and science fiction feel to something that is now science reality.
Mm-hmm. Well, Elon Musk and the folks at SpaceX certainly have a flair for creating buzz around their projects.
Yes, they do. I don't know if they're going to launch another fancy Tesla car and Starman mannequin, but they probably will do something incredible with their first Starship BFR launch.
Well, Laura Forsyk is a space policy analyst and founder of Astrolytical. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And Brendan Byrne is 90.7 Space reporter. Brendan, thank you as well.
Anytime, Matt.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Ashley Garrett. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.